Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Jerome Stern Writer Series. We are excited to have a really great reader for you tonight.
So up first to introduce Monica Yoon is Daniel Moisenko.
Monica Yoon is the author of Blackacre, finalist for the Book Critics Circle Award and longlisted for the 2016 National Book Award. Ignatz, a finalist for the 2010 National Book Award, and Barter. Her poems have been widely published, including in Poetry, The New Yorker, The New Republic, Lana Turner, The Paris Review, and The Best American Poetry. She currently teaches at Princeton University and in the Warren Wilson and Sarah Lawrence MFA programs. A former lawyer, she lives in New York. Yoon's speakers often actualize the invisible. Infertility, unstoppable patterns, imagined histories, by noticing and naming their visible effects on bodies. Ignatz presents its enamored and brick-hurdling subjects locked in their roles, at the mercy of a cycle of mutable identities. Obsessive desire here goes unfulfilled, much as a fairy, Yoon writes, will never satisfyingly clang against its dock because the gap is where such satisfaction helplessly dissolves. This gap similarly occurs in Blackacre, where hypothetical plots of land are made real by naming. A gallows spectacle, an inability to conceive, and a film sequence translated from Antonioni's The Passenger, for example, all trouble possession. Beyond figurative utility, such observation does service to the besieged, unseen, or undone. The actions of this government's executive branch make these poems especially important. Yoon shows us a mode of life that draws sustenance from the peripheries. By illuminating historical moments, she superimposes the past on the present, those present ghosts we are now asked to look for. And a variety of forms, from couplets and serial poems to prose blocks, allows Yoon to map her images across a linguistic plane spanning centuries. Her collections admirably make room for Latin and Old English etymological dissection, as much as words like Shazam, as well as those indestructible so-called sponge cakes, Twinkies. This multitude of registers augments linguistic richness, but also acts as an equalizer, encouraging the reader to draw parallels and see fictional property or a masked executioner if transformed here, now, before us. It is a terrifying but necessary revelation in metaphor. It is gorgeously rendered in a style so taut and fluid as to be her very own. It is a poetry befitting conversations with Villon and Milton, since Yoon extends those poets' concerns in directions astonishing to witness. In Yoon's collections, the materiality of and chasms within social spheres glow in their relation to the private and the bodily, just as we readers glow in being shown their complexities. Please join me in welcoming Monica Yoon.
Wow, that introduction was a work of art in itself, and I'm just I'm so gratified and stunned by it. And I'm just really very happy to be here. Thank you, Aaron and Keith, for inviting me and for setting all of this up. And thank you all for being here and for listening. I actually wanted to start with a poem that I read for the protests that Aaron organized, Writers Resist, that I wrote for this chapbook, Poems for Political Disaster, in the wake of the election. It's based on four definitions of the word mine. Can you hear me? A guide to usage, mine. Oh, so the first half of each section is a definition. A, pronoun, my, belonging to me. How should I define the limits of my concern, the boundary between mine and not mine, the chime of the pronoun like a steel ring cast over what I know, what I name, what I claim, what I own? The whine of the pronoun hones its edges to keenness because there is power in the categorical that prides itself and plumps itself and proliferates till there is no room in here for anything but power, till there is no air in here, but there would be no need for air if you could learn to breathe in whatever I breathe out. B, noun one. A pit or tunnel in the earth from which precious stones or ores or coal are taken by digging or by other methods. Because the earth does not gleam with the shine of the noun, to dig into the earth is imperative. To use my fingers or else to fashion more rigid, more perjurable fingers that cut or delve or sift or shatter, because we are more evolved than animals, because to mine is not to burrow, because the earth is not for us to live in, because the earth is not precious in itself, the earth is that from which what is precious is taken, what is scraped away or blasted away or melted away from what my steel tip fingers can display or sell or burn. C, noun two, a device intended to explode when stepped upon or touched or when approached by a ship, vehicle, or person. My device redefined by intent, so thin-skinned this earth is untouchable. A sly simulacrum of innocence concealing an infinity of hair trigger malice, the cry of the noun sealed in a concentric sphere that sheaths its lethal secret in silence. Unapproachable, it sings its unspeakable harvest in this field I have seeded with violence. D, verb, to dig away or otherwise remove the substratum or foundation of, to sap, to ruin by slow degrees or secret means. To dig is to build dark dwellings of negative space, to knit a linked network of nothing. The seams of the seemingly solid unravel, the itch of erosion, the scratch of collapse, each absence, the artifact of specific intention, an absence, an abscess, a crater, a honeycomb of dead husks. The home of the verb is founded on ruin. The crime of the verb hollows out prisons and graves. The rhyme of the verb tunnels from fissure to fracture, from factory to faction, from fault line to fate. This foundation is equal parts atom and emptiness. This fear invades fractally by rhizome and root. What cement could salvage this crumbling concrete? Should I pledge my allegiance to unearthing or earth? Thanks. So I'm going to read from this book, Blackacre. You know, the poem, I tend to come up with texts and then just obsess over them for a long time. So the first section of the book is based on a Ballad of the Hangman by François Villon, which is this 15th century French poem. And, you know, for those of you who don't know the poem, the setup is really fascinating. It's these men are hanging in the town square on a gallows, and they've been dead for some time. They're not in very good shape. They've started to get sort of leathery, and you know, birds have eaten bits of them, and they're hanging there, and they're meditating on their situation and on their condition and what brought them there. And, you know, and they kind of shift between, you know, very specific observations of what's happening, but also, you know, occasionally, like, you know, have these periodic pleas toward their townspeople and toward God for forgiveness, for absolution. The first poem in the book actually isn't in that series, but it's called Palinode. A palinode is a backwards song. It's a poem that retracts a statement that was made in a previous poem. One, a bird falls off a balcony, panicked, grasping fistfuls of air. Two, I was wrong, please, I was wrong, please, I wanted nothing, please, I don't want. Interrogation of the hanged man. What is your face? A house of sorts. What is your foot? A chipped stone blade. What did you dream? A rain-washed road. What did it mean? It meant nothing. What have you learned? The sky forgives. What does it forgive? Each jet its wake. What do you want? A smile of sorts. No, what do you want? I want nothing. What's in your hand? A leafless twig. No, show me. What's that in your hand? As you can tell, I'm sort of an etymology geek. So this one is, so catastrophe is kata, like under, and trophy, like trope, to turn, right? So catastrophe is a downturn. This also references the Greek goddess of necessity, who is usually figured as weaving something. Portrait of a hanged woman. The Greeks had it wrong. Catastrophe is not a downturn, not a fall from grace. No, it is the sudden, terrible elevation of a single point, one dot on the topography of a life. That is the crux of the punishment, the singling out, then that brutal uplifting. It is as if a steel clamp had seized upon one square inch of a flattened canvas map, then jerked sharply upward. The painted landscape cracking along unaccustomed creases, cities thrown into shadow, torqued bridges twisting free. A life is not this supple. It is not meant to fold, to be drawn through a narrow ring. The Greeks were wrong. Necessity is not a weaver. There is no spindle in her hand. It is a woman wearing a steel collar, wearing a stiffly pleated dress which lifts to reveal nothing but fabric where her body used to be. That was one portrait of a hanged woman. The portraits of the hanged woman are portraits of my mother, who kind of reached a point of crisis in her life. This is the other portrait of a hanged woman. Now she could see that the air filling their rooms was supersaturated, thick with unspent silences. It was starting to precipitate out, the silences spinning themselves into filaments just below the surface of the visible. They drifted whitely upward like seed floss releasing from summer trees. They clustered together at the darkened ceilings of that house. They made no sound, of course. It would have been contrary to their nature. But sometimes she could feel a small, pleased patterning of the air, like a cool current deep underwater. Over time, they flourished, doubling and redoubling into braids and garlands, lustrous, self-satisfied. They were long enough now to brush with her fingertips, then to drape around her shoulders, necklaces, scarves. They had the seamlessness of the fur of a healthy animal. She learned to trust in their cohesion, their tensile strength. She knew herself still to be a creature bounded by gravity, but now she could travel from room to room, never touching the floor. She sensed his approaching footsteps, not as sound nor even as vibration, but only as a stirring among the coils at her throat. Self-portrait in a wire jacket. To section off is to intensify, to deaden. Some surfaces cannot be salvaged. Leave them, to lose function, to exist only as armature, holding in place those radiant squares of sensation, the body a dichotomy of flesh and blood. Wait, here in the trellised garden you are becoming. Soon you'll know that the strictures have themselves become superfluous, but at that point, you'll also know that ungridded, you could no longer survive. And then the title of the book, as referenced in the introduction, is Blackacre. Blackacre is to property as John Doe is to a person. It's a hypothetical placeholder term. And so in law school, you get endless numbers of law school exams that, law school questions that are, you know, John Doe transfers his property Blackacre to Jane Roe in exchange for her property Whiteacre. And so there's a sequence of these hypothetical properties. And so I was thinking about property, legacy, limit, what we are given, inheritance. And the first one I'll read is pretty simple. It's just a landscape, Brownacre. After the clear plastic sheeting has been pulled back, folded away, after each woody rhizome has been pried loose from the soil, each snarl of roots traced to its capillary ends, twigs and pebbles tossed aside, worms reburied elsewhere, after the soil has been rubbed through a sieve, after the ground has been leveled with rakes and stakes and string, no need for further labor, further motion. Nothing has been sown. Nothing is germinating in the raw dirt. The light strikes each granule the same as any other. A windlessness rises, becomes a precondition. Why is it hard to admit you couldn't live here? No one could live here. This is not the texture of the real, lacking attachment, lacking event. This is neither landscape nor memory. This is parable, a caricature of restraint. But why does this shame you? Even now, you're trying to hide that your gaze is drifting upward. This plainness cannot hold your attention. You're searching the sky for some marker of time, of change. In a cloudless sky, the sun beats down. But if you observe that the sun warms the soil, you must also concede that the soil must grow colder. The sun stains only the body, and the body is what is simply not at issue here. So this one is called Whiteacre. It was actually written on a challenge from my colleague Michael Dickman. A number of us had small babies, and the challenge was to write a poem during the period of your baby's nap time. Luckily, my son was still taking 2.5 hour naps at the time, so I had a little more time than other people did. But at the time of Toby's birth, we lived very close to City Hall and to Foley Square, where the courthouses are in New York. And so during his naps, we would put on his white noise machine. And what the machine was drowning out were the Black Lives Matter protests, the protesters and the sirens and the helicopters. Was all being kind of muffled by this white noise. And, you know, white noise is interesting to think about because it's just the same sine wave repeated over and over. And I was thinking about what does it mean that we are taught so early that to cloak ourselves in sameness is somehow comforting, to insulate ourselves in sameness. And so this is called, and the epigraph is from the White Noise app that we downloaded onto the iPhone, Whiteacre. You have probably noticed if you're in a brightly lit room filled with white light, it is difficult to see colored lights. That's because those individual colors get masked by surrounding white light. In the same way, other sounds will get masked by white noise, so they become less detectable. Proleptic flinch of whiteness, the hunch of shouldering into it, stoic glitch zipping up its jacket of static, knit fabric of interlocking Z's. the apotropaic as abject self-replicating reflex of self-defense, vain camouflage that functions as neither shield nor shelter, the canker's milk nourishes nothing, the ice rink exudes only its own doom. This is Redacre. It's loosely based on Nicholas Roeg's film Don't Look Now with Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, kind of an amazing film, in which there's a scene where at the beginning their little girl has drowned, and she was wearing a red raincoat, and there's a photograph of a little girl, and a drop of water falls on the emulsion, so the redness starts to run. I guess I started with that image, but it has actually very little to do with this poem. Redacre couldn't stop himself picking his red lest it pinken, lest it pale itself into mere proud flesh, mere scar. New skin makes a smooth mound. Hurt hungers for rebirth. The mouth that eats everything then eats itself raw. This next one is about the sponge cake Twinkies, which in my junior high school, the idea, the urban legend going around was that Twinkies weren't actually baked, that they were this kind of goo that was extruded and then was exposed to some sort of chemical that caused them to foam up, right? And so they kind of grew this golden foamy layer outside of this gooey inner layer, and then they sort of brushed the bottoms with some brown stuff to make it look as if they had been baked. And this turns out not to be true. I found out only when I started researching this poem. And Twinkie, of course, is also an urban slang for someone who's yellow on the outside and white on the inside. And I think the other thing that's worth saying about this poem is it's written in the subjunctive, and the subjunctive in English is, you know, the subjunctive is the way we talk about fantasy, you know, unreality, what, you know, but, you know, in some sense, unrealized desire. And it's often indistinguishable in English from the past tense. So you are becomes as if you were, right? The construction is very similar. And I was thinking about the way in which fantasies, especially racial fantasies, racist fantasies, like to cloak themselves in the language of the past. So, you know, Aryanism and Gone with the Wind and Make America Great Again. The value added by that again, right, is this gesture back to this, you know, to this sanitized, mythologized white past in which supposedly everything was great. And so that's also part of what this is about. Goldacre. As if you were ever wide-eyed enough to believe in urban legends. As if these plot elements weren't the stalest of cliches, the secret lab, the anaerobic chamber, the gloved hand ex machina, the chemical-infused fog. As if every origin story didn't center on the same sweet myth of a lost wholeness. As if such longing would seem more palatable if packaged as nostalgia. As if there had once been a moment of unity, smoothly numinous, pellucid, as if inner and outer were merely phases of the same substance, as if this whiteness had been your original condition, as if it hadn't been what was piped into you, what seeped into each vacant cell, each air hole, each pore, as if you had started out skinless, shameless, blameless, creamy, as if whipped, passive, as if extruded, quivering with volatility in a metal mold. As if a catalyzing vapor triggered a latent reaction, as if your flesh foamed up, a hydrogenated emulsion consisting mostly of trapped air. As if though sponge-like, you could remain shelf-stable for decades, part embalming fluid, part rocket fuel, part glue. As if you had been named twin, a word for likeness, or wink, a word for joke, or ink, a word for stain, or key, a word for answer. As if your skin oxidized to its present burnished hue, golden, as if homemade. Thanks. So this next one starts to get to what the book is really about, which is, you know, my son, I have a son. He's not genetically mine. I seem to have undergone premature ovarian failure, like in my late 20s or something, which I only discovered when we wanted to have a baby. And you know, it took me a long time to come to terms with that and to actually go through the process of having finding an egg donor and you know, having our son. And you know, and afterwards, as I, you know, I was writing this book mostly while I was pregnant, and I was thinking, well, why did I, you know, with this great impending happiness, right? And I was thinking, why did I put myself through those years and years of therapy and just, you know, just everything, every possible treatment, all of this expense, all of this heartbreak. You know, why did I put myself through that? And I started to think, well, you know, how is it that women are valued in society? And what does that have to do with property? You know, if John Doe wants to pass Blackacre down to John Doe Jr., then he has to make sure that Jane Doe is young, is fertile, and is faithful. And there becomes this whole economic incentive to stigmatize and punish women who are aging, women who are infertile, and women who are unfaithful. And we see that reflected in law, and we see that reflected also in social norms and in the stories that we tell ourselves, starting at very young ages, where you have little girls, you know, pushing their little strollers when, you know, when they're still in diapers. And I was thinking in particular of Peter Pan, Peter and Wendy, the J.M. Barrie novel, is this very beautiful, very strange, very sinister book. And I was captivated, I'd always been captivated by this one scene in it, where the Lost Boys desperately want Wendy, you know, this little girl, to come to Neverland and to stay with them, to be their mother. And so they decide to build her a house. And it's explained in the book that all of the building materials they have are these vines that are lying around, and these vines are oozing the sticky red sap. So they build this kind of sticky red veiny house for Wendy, and it's like, wow, that's not subtle, is it? So anyways, the epigraph here is from Peter and Wendy, Redacre. Of course, Slightly was the first to get his word in. "Wendy, lady," he said, "for you we built this house." "Oh, say you're pleased," cried Nibs. "Lovely, darling house," Wendy said, and they were the very words they had hoped she would say. "And we are your children," cried the twins. Then all went on their knees and, holding out their arms, cried, "Oh, Wendy, lady, be our mother." "Ought I?" Wendy said, all shining. "Of course, it's frightfully fascinating, but you see, I am only a little girl. I have no real experience." In a scheme to entice her, they fashioned a shrine with jewel work of berries, with cruel work of vines, red mullions flaunting flocked velvet drapes, rose patterned carpets in plush piled heaps. At the pulsating heart of this upholstered nest, a snug seat like a socket that whispered of rest. "But I can't be your mother. I'm not ready yet." And the eaves of the little home slumped with regret, and its sorrow turned inward, turned acid, turned foul, and corrosion traced stencils in slime on the wall, and the draperies puddled in ponds on the floor, and the overripe cushions ruptured like sores. The seat melted to nothing, a hollowed-out void drained away everything in a purgative flood. More taboo than urine, an effluvial flow streamed toward the sewers, a liquefied no. Wide-eyed and wide-mouthed, she gaped in dismay as pearl-like the possibles went floating away. And then, okay, ooh, we're further along than I thought. So this is I'll read, The two title poems are called Blackacre. I'll read one and sections from the other. The first title poem is based on a sonogram that they did of what seems to have been my last viable egg. Blackacre. One day they showed me a dark moon ringed with a bright nimbus on a swirling gray screen. They called it my last chance for never-ending life. But the next day, it was gone. It had already launched itself into the gray sky like an escape capsule, accidentally empty, sent spiraling into the unpeopled galaxies of my trackless gray body. So Erin tells me that she makes her students memorize poems. and this is exciting to me because, the title sequence here is based on Milton's sonnet on his blindness, which a high school teacher made me memorize when I think I was 16. And it's always been my sort of safety blanket poem. You know, I recite it when I'm waiting like for the elevator or for the subway. And, you know, it's always been something soothing for me. And the poem, for those of you who, I can recite it, I will. When I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent, which is death to hide, lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my maker and present my true account, lest he returning chide. Doth God exact day labor light denied? I fondly ask. But patience to prevent that murmur soon replied, God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly, thousands at his bidding, speed and post or land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. So as I said, I get a lot of thanks. This is my like third grade piano recital mode, but as I said, I used to get a lot of comfort out of this poem, and I noticed that when I was in this kind of frenzy of infertility and trying to deal with it, this poem ceased to be comforting to me because all I would see is I would see these words like spent, prevent, useless, denied, chide, wait, and you know, that was all I could see out of the poem. And so I wrote this, I wrote a 14-part poem, I will only read sections of it, that sort of in which each section is based on one of the end words of the poem. And it starts off kind of lawyery, it starts off very analytical, so I'll read the first section. Spent. In Sonnet 19, Milton makes the seemingly deliberate choice to avoid thee and a, respectively the most common and the six most common words in English usage. Instead of these articles, definite and indefinite, the poem stages a territorial dispute between possessives. The octave is my land, the sestet is his land, with the occasional this or that flagging no man's land. We come to understand Milton's mistake, the professed regret of the poem, as this act of claiming. It is only through his taking possession that the universal light is divided up, apportioned into my light, a finite commodity that by being subjected to ownership becomes capable of being spent. Spent, a word like a flapping sack. My mistake was similar. I came to consider my body, its tug of war of tautnesses and slacknesses, to be entirely my own, an appliance for generating various textures and temperatures of friction. Should I have known then by this act of self-claiming, I was cutting myself off from the eternal, the infinite, that I had fashioned myself into a resource that was bounded and therefore exhaustible. 2. Wide. The wide is always haunted by surprise. In a dark world, the wide is the sudden door that opens on unfurling blackness, the void pooling at the bottom of unlit stairs. To be bounded is our usual condition. To be open is anomalous, even excessive. A wide-eyed girl is extreme in her unliddedness, her bare membranes flinching at any contact, vulnerable to motes, to smuts, to dryness. A wide-hipped girl extends the splayed arches of her body to bridge the generational divides. A wide-legged girl unseals a portal between persons. She is disturbing to the extent that she is open to all comers, a trapdoor that must be shut for safety's sake. A wide-eyed girl is often thought desirable. A wide-hipped girl is often thought eligible. A wide-legged girl is often thought deplorable. A wide-legged girl is rarely wide-eyed, though she may have started out that way. We can understand why Milton, in the narrowing orbit of his blindness, would have considered wideness, unboundedness, to be threatening. What's less clear is why the wideness of the wide-legged girl is also considered threatening. Does the wideness of the wide-legged girl evoke a kind of blindness, a dark room where one might blunder into strangers the way two men once met each other in me? I'm going to read a couple from the turn of the sonnet. This is Prevent. It cites a letter that Milton wrote to an optician friend of his, trying to figure out what was going on with his encroaching blindness. 8. Prevent. Prevent, a word like a white sheet folded back to cover the mouth. A white egg bursts from the ovary and falls away, leaving a star-shaped scar. Corpus albicans, the whitening body. Such starbursts at first are scattered constellations, frost embroidering a dark field. But at what point does this white lacework shift over from intricacy to impossibility, opacity, obstacle, the ice disk clogging the round pond, the grid of proteins baffling the eye? Prevent, a word that slams shut, a portcullis, Latin cataracta. Letter to Leonard Phalaris, September 28, 1654. The dimness which I experience night and day seems to incline more to white than to black. 9, need. So what's happening here is patience, to prevent that murmur, soon replied, God doth not need. So patience comes in at the turn of the sonnet. And what's sort of interesting is Milton never gets a word in afterwards. It's just patience talking for the rest of the poem. And, you know, it's sort of like, well, what does Milton think about all of this? But 9, need. Has patience been looming in the background all along, silent so as not to intrude upon a blind man's consciousness? Patience, whose garment is white and close-fitting so that it is not blown about or disturbed by the wind. At the turn of the sonnet, patience pries open its sculpted lips, its stiff tongue like a weaver's shuttle drawing woolly strands through the warp and weft of Milton's blindness, a white monologue that admits neither interruption nor rejoinder. Milton's little murmur stitched back into his mouth. Woven tight enough to repel need, a liquid beating on the surface, the blood the needles drew from me week after week, hundreds of stoppered vials consigned to the biohazard bin en route to the incinerator. Need from the High German for danger. Murmur from the Sanskrit, a crackling fire. I'll just end with the last two sections, one of which is quite short. So what's happening here is thousands at his bidding speed and post or land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. 13, rest. Rest, a word like a gauze bandage, a ropey weave of collagen knitting its way across a wound. Outspread as a fingered, gelid gesture suggesting solace, to stanch, to shield, to seal, to shut off. Rest, the rind of the best, a contoured pod that cradles the shape of what it doesn't hold. Rest, those who are left when thousands have sped away, the bereft who litter the land with husks for hands, vacant-eyed, vacant faces raised like basins under the contrail's scarred sky. 14. Wait. To stand and wait is a task far weightier than simple waiting. It is to permit the distractible body neither ease nor action, nor food, nor drink, nor any such reprieve. It is to pit the body in enmity against its own heaviness, to abide in readiness as in a winter orchard, the lacerated land bandaged in snow, to exist inert as if limbless, skin seamless as if re-knit over what had been pruned away, knotted rootstock fit for no other service, no branch, no leaf, no fruit. To persist as a stripped stick persists in a white field, bark peeled back from one exposed split, uptilted as if eager for the grafted slip. Mercy sugars the starving soil with nitrogen, potassium, phosphate. Mercy captures rain in silver beads and stitches them through the threadbare weave of cloud. Mercy wields a scalpel, cutting a cleft in the lopped-off stump. Mercy forces home the rootless wand. Mercy seals the join with tar and tape. To foster the raw scion as if it were a sun. To siphon light down through its body as if it were your own. Thank you.